begins the technical net. And this is technical net number 1,499, which I believe. Almost coming up to the 1,500th one. They all began 31 and a fraction years ago, roughly September 1982, is when the TechNet began. We've had a lot of people ask an awful lot of questions over that time, and almost all of that is recorded, at least the last 6.5 years of it. You can go to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you'll find 4 separate reels of 1 hour each, recordings of past technical nets. Also, the man who runs that particular website does an extremely good job. That's Mike Perry, KC2NJI. He has a number of the more popular subjects like what do decibels mean and how do you use a Smith chart. Let me drop it. Mike at that website has some cross-referencing where that particular kind of a subject you can look up, and it'll tell you which sessions where that subject was discussed, and therefore you can go directly to them. And you can also get copies of charts like the Smith chart and the Brown and Woodward curves and things like this, things that amateurs who are interested in building antennas and understanding how things work can find that information. Let me drop it. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. We amateurs gather at this TechNet and instruct each other, teach each other. There's a large amount of brain power in the New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut, lower New York State, Long Island, Western Long Island area. And as such, quite often when a particular subject is discussed, somebody in that area will chime in and say, I've got some experience in this particular one, and this is my opinion, this is my experience, this is my favorite rig, and so on. Not all the TechNets are interesting, depending on whether or not a particular TechNet, a particular Sunday evening, is going to be a good one or a bad one. It's primarily a function of what questions you guys ask, because for the most part, we don't have a canned program and a definite subject selected ahead of time. You guys choose interesting subjects, it will have an interesting TechNet. Another thing I wanted to mention is that, I guess, John, you mentioned the fact that there is somebody who wants to give a piece of information before we start. Let me turn that over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Yes, that's true. Joe, the educational chair for Limark, would like to make an announcement about his extra exam, I believe, coming up this Saturday. So if you can, when you get it, turn it over to him, and he'll do what he has to do. Back to you, Dick.
Very, very, John. Joe, why don't you take your time right now and announce your educational class. You've got it, Joe, T2LIW.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Dick. Just wanted to remind everybody there's going to be a VE session at Levittown Hall this Saturday, that's the 29th, at 1 p.m. If you're looking to upgrade your license, it's a good time to do that. Our general license class will be meeting there. We're expecting about 15 or 20 people to be there to take their general exam. Also, the extra class is something we offer on the web, and it's all web-based, instructor-led. If you're interested in upgrading to your extra license, just contact me, whiskey2bravomikepapa at limark.org. Thank you, Dick. Thanks, John.
Sounds awful good, Joe. The very last session you had, I think you might want to repeat the track record. I believe you had something like 85% or a good number of guys who attempted the test, actually passed it. So, why don't you run those numbers by one more time? How many applied and how many passed on your last VE session, Joe? W2BMP, K2LIW.
On the technical class, we had 10 people attend the class. We had 100% pass rate on the technical. The general class is just winding down this week, but some people took it early. had 22 registered students. The class is not finished, and yet four of them already passed their general. We're hoping for another 100% ratio here.
Rather good track record, Joe. I remember way back in the dark ages, I gave a class for people who wanted to pass the general class license, and an awful lot of fun if you have a reasonable understanding of the way electronics work. Okay. Good luck with that one, Joe. The schedule that we normally follow on the TechNet, and we change it somewhat from time to time, but the schedule we follow is that during the first hour from 9 to 10, here we go, 8 to roughly 9, when Cosmos starts, we discuss general subjects. In other words, guys will ask questions, and we try to get answers to those. And so this group of guys, John KC2WG, DV, Dick K2LAW, and Hal K6DPZ, attempt to give answers to those. And we quite often also get other information from people in the New York City tri-state area and beyond listening. Another thing we should do, let me drop. Once every three or four passing back and forth of the baton, so to speak, we should wait for the four beeps and a little bit beyond that, so that people outside of the area have a chance to sign in. The way the IRLP and Echo Link works is that they need an extra delay time in order to be admitted to the system. So we got to give them a chance. When I do pass it over to you, it's very tempting to pick up the mic and squeeze immediately. Try to make sure you wait for at least the four beeps on each time. So during that first hour, we ask and try to answer general questions. That's followed by John going to the mailbag, KC2WGB, who will choose two, three, or four of the snail mails, letters, and pigeon messages that he has gotten of guys who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment so that they can sign into the TechNet and talk to us live. That's then followed by Paul, WSTUN, who tells us what's the latest with the Aeronautics and Space, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Let me drop. And after that, with whatever time is left over, we go into deeper subjects. And some people really like the deeper subjects and some do not. But you've been forewarned, and you know what's going to happen ahead of time. Okay, at this time I'm going to be taking check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name, followed by the word yes. And the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in because you're listening. Right now, after 31 years and 1,500 tech nets, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. So give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is Jeff.
What am I watching?
And I think it's on channel 5.
Okay, that was a triple, but I think I got some of them. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, who I believe is telling us that Cosmos tonight will be the third session. It's going to be on the subject of comets, and it starts at 9 o'clock on Channel 5, 9 to 10. And if you happen to miss it on one particular Sunday night, to my knowledge, it does get repeated the very next Saturday night from 8 to 9. Very good series. Already, I think I also heard Barry, N2MB. Is that true, Barry, you're signing in? N2MB, K2LIW.
Yeah, but I got my answer. That's what I wanted to know, what time Cosmos was on. So now I'm just going to listen. I'm in my car, and I'm going to listen to you guys. No more questions. That was my question.
Hey, Barry, after all these years of ham radio, and you and I go back to the dark ages, you got to come up with a question. Okay, so we got Joe so far and Barry. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the deck then.
KD2F2U, name is Don. Yes.
Okay, I heard Don, and it sounds like Hilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Delta Uniform. Did I have that correct, Don?
At Quebec Uniform.
Okay, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform. one of those sets of call letters that have a sound that can easily be confused. Okay, so we got Joe, Barry maybe, and Don. Anyone else for checking? Give me your call letters and name right now.
To VBN, Freddy.
Kilo Charlie 2, Whiskey Bravo Delta, Tony, Bayshore.
Okay, I heard Freddy and Tony. Tony, give me your call letters again.
From Kilo Charlie 2, Whiskey Bravo Delta. Good evening, everybody.
Whiskey Bravo Delta, we got you. And Freddy, VBN, you have signed in quite a few times to the TechNet, and when we finally get around to going back to you, you're no longer there. So my guess is you have to leave each night to go to work or whatever. Roughly how long will you be there, Freddy? K2LIW.
Roger, I should be here for a good 2 hours there.
Dick. Very fine, Freddy. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I'd like you to ask Freddy if he's transmitting from his normal location with normal power and the same radio, because Eric made some changes today and he sounds much better, as you know. Just a quick question for you. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a good one, John. Freddy, how many watts are you running? What antenna are you using, and how high is that antenna? It's sounding awful good tonight. You got it, Freddy. VBN, K2LAW.
I'm using a 25 watts, and I'm using an MFJ antenna on a piece of sheet metal on ground level by the beach. One block from the beach.
Is normal MO?
Is that your normal location, your normal way of operating, Freddy? Because quite often your signal is very weak, and tonight you're potent. Go ahead, Freddy.
I bought a new radio, the Yaesu 7900. Just got it the other day.
Okay, so you're running 25 watts now. Roughly how many watts did you used to run, Freddy?
Before I was running four watts.
Okay, so that's part of it. 4 watts to 25 is a good potent increase. Keep it up, Freddy. And as John and I will often say, more power to you. Okay. Let me go over to Joe first. W-H-O-R-Y-Y. Joe, how are things with you? How are those electrons, those RF electrons treating you these days? K2LAW in the TechNet.
Oh, very good, Dick. They just keep on spinning round and round and round. Here's a question that I've asked before, but I don't know. Maybe it's just a good one to review again. Bring up people who've never heard this before, this subject approach. And that's measuring the effective sensitivity of a receiving system. And it doesn't have to be on a repeater. It could be really anything. But this is more gauged towards doing something on a receiving system on a repeater. Many of us know that you can take a signal generator and put it into the receiver and say the receiver checks fine. And then you plug it into your antenna and listen to the outside world, and it doesn't really work as well as you'd like it to work. What would you say would be the best way to really effectively measure the, so to speak, online sensitivity of a receiving system? Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to measuring sensitivity of a receiver, lots and lots of ways of doing it. And the way you does it, the way you do it also depends on what kind of a receiver. In the case of trying to test the ultimate sensitivity for a single sideband receiver, you might be using a very different technique than you would with an FM receiver. In the old days, people would connect a good signal generator, hopefully it's reasonably well calibrated, to the front end of a receiver with a nice piece of cable. Hopefully it's a good piece of cable you're using. And you slowly crank the dial clockwise, starting at the lowest the signal generator can go. And you crank the signal generator, and hopefully the signal generator is right on the center frequency of the receiver. And that in itself is another problem to worry about. Is your receiver properly centered on the signal generator? In the old days of using something like a Hewlett-Packard 608, which used to be called the driftometer, that signal generator would have to warm up for a couple of hours in order for the drift rate, the frequency swishing rate, to slow down enough that it could stay in the center of your receiver. Let me drop it. And how do you make sure that it's in the center of the receiver? You crank up the dial so you know you got a strong enough signal, and you swish it around the right frequency, so to speak. Modern-day signal generators that are frequency synthesized, and modern-day receivers that are also frequency synthesized, the frequency accuracy problem and the frequency drifting problem almost disappears, almost. But you got to be careful with that. So in the old days, you would crank the signal generator up, because the way an FM receiver works, when there's no signal there, and you have the squelch turned off, you hear a whole lot of noise in the loudspeaker, and you turn up the signal generator with no modulation on the signal in the old days until you've got 20 decibels of quieting. You put some kind of a 2 RMS audio voltmeter on the loudspeaker circuit, and you have to make sure the loudspeaker is not set too high in volume so that the audio amplifier is distorting, and not too low in volume so that the hum in the receiver is dominating into the voltmeter. There's all kinds of things you got to worry about there. But you turned it up until the noise in the background got 20 decibels of quieting. That's the old technique. And Motorola and other people realized there's a much better technique, because every real receiver has got some amount of hum, some amount of distortion, some amount of noise as a function of noise figure, some amount of noise as a function of spurious responses, and so on. So they came up with a more elaborate technique. Let me drop. And the more elaborate technique is called 12 dB SINAD. S-I-N-A-D stands for signal to noise and distortion. So you would now start off with a signal generator with 1 kilohertz of modulating rate at just the right amplitude of modulation, which I think is around 5 kc of deviation. So you start off with the right amount of deviation, 1 kilohertz of modulating rate, and you've got a very special SINAD detecting piece of equipment. A good service monitor has that function built into it, and you turn up the signal generator until the meter tells you there is 12 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio, you could call it, the signal-to-noise and distortion ratio. And it's a more accurate test. So a good receiver, bear in mind, burn into your mind one very handy number. 1 microvolt of signal on a 50-ohm coaxial cable represents minus 107 dBm. So if you like the dBm scale, if you like the microvolt scale, 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. A really good receiver, a hot receiver, will give you either 20 dB of quieting with the old technique, or 12 dB of SINAD with the new technique, with something in the vicinity of 1/4 of 1 microvolt. A really hot receiver. An acceptable receiver, a good handy talkie, is in the vicinity of 0.5 microvolt of sensitivity. Okay. So on the laboratory conditions on your bench, with a good signal generator that's synthesized, well calibrated, good piece of cable into your receiver under test, your FM receiver, you make those measurements. Let me drop. Now you take that particular receiver, and I'm now going to go to the worst case possible scenario. Assume that's a handy talkie, and you go to floor number 89 at the top of the Empire State Building, and whatever instrumentation you've got, or you've done a calculation, you know that your buddy is 30 miles out from the Empire State Building. You've got line of sight to that guy. He's running a 5-watt transmitter. You've done the calculation, and maybe you say that his signal should be 20 dB above your noise. He should be giving you a dead, full, quieting signal when he transmits and you're listening. But if you're standing on the 89th floor, the observation deck of the Empire State Building, and right above you is that 300-foot mast with a zillion broadcast transmitters on channel 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, a whole bunch of UHF channels, a whole bunch of two-way radios and whatever, the total amount of RF in that environment is so hot that your receiver, if it's not the most bulletproof thing in the world, but with the most high-quality bandpass filter on the front end that passes nothing but your ham radio frequency and rejects everything else by 80 dB, unless you've got that kind of a massive, high-quality filter in front of that receiver, and the rest of the receiver is well-filtered, so that the signals coming out of those broadcast transmitters that are a few hundred feet away from you can't sneak in by way of the battery leads and everything else and give you a funny response. So what I'm getting at is your receiver in that environment. You'll hear all kinds of noise coming out of the loudspeaker. You won't hear your buddy. And the next worst situation I can think of happened on when Owen Garriott was on the space shuttle number 9, I think it was. Let me drop. This is roughly the summer of 1985. And Owen Garriott was coming over the horizon. I did the calculations. I went out to my automobile in the parking lot of AIL with a mag mount antenna and 20 watts out of that transmitter. And I gave a shout to Owen Garriott as I knew at what period of time he would be listening on what frequency as the space shuttle came by. And Owen didn't respond. And when I bought that piece of tape recording and listened to what he was listening to, I soon found out why. I did manage to talk to Owen, so to speak, but what I had to do was a kilowatt transmitter, 4 Yagis carefully aimed at him, and I was trying to give him a signal that's 40 dB above threshold, if you know what I mean, because I had to climb above the rabble. By that I mean he is 180 miles in the air on top of the space shuttle. He is looking at a 1,500-mile diameter of humanity all at once, a zillion hams all shouting at him, as well as all of those broadcast transmitters and all of those radars and everything else are all within line of sight of him. So that FM Motorola handy-talkie that he was using with an antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle, which didn't have the filter I'm describing, he just used a barefoot handy-talkie. He had tested it in the laboratory. It worked like a charm. He assumed that on the space shuttle, it's also going to work like a charm. When you listen to that tape recording, everything is wall-to-wall intermodded because of those zillions of simultaneous transmitters he was being subjected to. And only an occasional guy who's running a moon-bounce rig, so to speak, blasting a kilowatt of energy up to him with a high-gain antenna specifically aimed at the space shuttle, those are the guys that got through when he was over the center of the United States. There was an exception. Let me drop. When the space shuttle was over the Mideast, and he talked to King Hussein, at that particular time, there were very few other hams around, and so they had a private conversation, and no problem. And there weren't a whole lot of nearby broadcast transmitters and so on. So, every receiver has something called a third-order intermodulation distortion product, or a third-order intercept point. This is a mathematically derived number, which is measured in a laboratory by putting two simultaneous signals into the receiver, one that's on frequency and one that's off frequency. You can measure blocking dynamic range. You can measure intermodulation distortion. There's lots of ways, if you're smart enough, that you can make some kind of measurement in a laboratory which gives you a little bit of an indication as to how bad the receiver is going to behave when you put it in a real environment, like, for instance, near New York City, which has got a whole lot of transmitters. So part of what's going on is that every receiver, let me drop. We all think that we've got a line-of-sight situation. I've got my transmitting antenna on top of my tower, and let me pick a number 20 miles away on top of your tower. You've got a receiving antenna, and you've got a line-of-sight environment, and you assume the signal goes directly from my transmitting antenna over to your receiving antenna. You'd like to believe that's what's happening. And that's one of a million things that's happening. That one particular signal is bouncing off everything in the environment, all the buildings and trees and water towers and ground and houses and everything else. And there's a zillion antenna signals coming into that antenna simultaneously. And they all get added together. Sometimes they add in a co-phase manner, and sometimes they add in an anti-phase manner. You get a null until you move something a foot, if you know what I mean. So lots and lots of signals are coming into that situation. However, even if you could stop all of the extraneous signals and you had nothing but the main signal, what we keep forgetting about is what a real radio signal is like. Let me drop. I might be putting 70 watts into my transmitting antenna on a 70-ohm transmission line going into a 70-ohm dipole. 70 watts happens to be 70 volts at 1 ampere. So I'm putting in 1 ampere, I'm putting 70 volts into my transmitting antenna, and 20 miles away, you're listening to a signal that is some number of microvolts. The signal is getting there, but the percentage of the signal that gets there is by ordinary mathematics so extremely small, it'll amaze the hell out of you. As such, almost every self-respecting receiver you've ever used or you're ever likely to use has in the vicinity of 120 decibels of gain between the front end, the antenna, and the loudspeaker. The good news is that it can take these extremely weak signals and gain them up like crazy, and now you hear something coming out of the loudspeaker that sounds pretty good to you. But along with that 120 decibels of gain, that power gain of 120 decibels means that the ratio of power transmitted versus the ratio of power received is 1 with 12 zeros after it. That's a huge number ratio. We're talking about it's trillion. It's a trillion to one ratio, so to speak, between the power transmitted and the power received. The good news is that if there's only one signal there and you got all of that gain, it comes through the receiver very nicely. But all of that gain has got a very nasty characteristic. If a very small number of kilohertz or megahertz away, there is another extremely strong signal that maybe is a puck away from you. You're trying to listen to the signal 20 miles away, and there's an extremely strong signal one block away from you that's giving you a signal that's 50 or 60 decibels stronger than the one you want to listen to. And when that gets cranking through your receiver, it's going to do some funny things. So in the real world, tracking down...
Repeater, timeout.
In the real world, to try to track down what is the offending signal or signals that's giving you the grief, one of the best ways in the world would be to connect your antenna system that's doing the receiving into a well-calibrated, high dynamic range spectrum analyzer or a service monitor that's being used in the spectrum analyzer mode. A spectrum analyzer is a kind of receiver that very rapidly sweeps across a very wide chunk of frequencies and displays them on an oscilloscope, where amplitude of signal is the vertical axis and the horizontal axis is frequency. And now you'll see all of those signals, sort of like a pan adapter, but it's a high-quality version of a pan adapter. So when your receiver acts in ways that are really different than you expect, and if you have the ability to connect a spectrum analyzer onto that antenna, you'll very rapidly find out some of the grief that that poor receiver of yours is being hammered by. I mean, it's trying to listen to an infinitesimal signal, and somebody's hitting it in the head with a hammer at the exact same time. Some strong local signal or multiple signals. So there's a whole art and science to find out how vulnerable, how bulletproof is your particular receiver. And every one of those situations, if you're willing to apply the technology, is a solvable situation. It's a kind of EMC, electromagnetic compatibility, or EMI, electromagnetic interference. You use the right kind of filters in front of that receiver with the right kind of shielding on the receiver. You can correct that condition. It is absolutely possible for you to bring a piece of hardware that you could put into your attaché case. You could bring it to floor number 89 of the Empire State Building on that observation deck, and you would be able to hear your buddy 30 miles away. But you better have one hell of a filter if you're going to try to do that. Maybe that's some of the information you're looking for, Joe. So B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that was a very good piece of various input information, but what you didn't really get at is how would you actually know what your actual receiving sensitivity is in that particular type of environment? Yes, I understand that you could be in a complex and armed environment, and you may have overloading, high noise floor, and so forth, but how would you actually, in your opinion, what would you actually do to determine your effective receiver sensitivity? Back to you.
Okay. Let's assume now that I wanted to find out, in that worst-case scenario, I didn't put that super-duper filter in front of my receiver. My receiver is listening to a signal from either its rubber duck or a Yagi antenna I'm holding in my hand or whatever. And it's going into that receiver, and I know that before I got there, in a friendly environment of my laboratory, I measured a half a microvolt of sensitivity on my real good handy talkie. And I bring it to floor 86, the observation deck of the Empire State Building, and I want to know, in that environment, today, at this hour, what is my real sensitivity? And the answer is, you use one of these little bugging devices. It's a kind of a T connector between the antenna and your receiver. You plug in what looks like a T connector. The straight through path between the antenna and the receiver has essentially no insertion loss. But off to one side, there's a small capacitive coupling device which allows you to sneak in a signal. And that coupling device, you may set it for 20 or 30 decibels of loss. That's your method of making sure that it's not creating any real insertion loss on the straight through path. So on this T connector off to one side, you've calibrated it ahead of time, and in this example, you know it's got 30 decibels of loss because it's got a very wide gap on, it's got a great big gap between the semiconductor of the T function and the rest of the straight through function of that T connector. It's not really connected, it's just nearby. And there's a small, a fraction of a picofarad capacitor coupling in a signal that's 30 dB down. Now I crank up my very strong signal generator until I measure sensitivity in that environment. The real environment's coming through the antenna. The real environment's going into the receiver. Let me drop. And by way of that coupling device, I'm now cranking up a signal generator. And I'm going to have to crank the signal generator to great big numbers. But eventually I will measure the sensitivity of that receiver with my signal generator. And whether you do it by 20 dB of quieting or 12 dB of SINAD, that's your choice and how well you're equipped. Now, let's assume now that I measure, in this particular example, that it takes not minus 107, let's say it takes a minus 70 dBm signal out of my signal generator to measure sensitivity. And I know that my coupling device has got 30 dB of loss. So minus 70 is really minus 100. Is what's really getting into the receiver because of the 30 dB of loss of my coupling device. I now know that minus 100 dBm is somewhere in around in the vicinity of 2 microvolts. So in this example, I would measure that in that particular environment of the Empire State Building, I'm now measuring 2 microvolts of sensitivity of that receiver, which in my home really measures a quarter of a microvolt. I've lost a 16 dB or something like that of sensitivity because of the environment I'm in this particular example. That's one way of doing it. And I'll bet you've done that some way, sometimes, with your repeaters, Joe. By way of that coupling device, I'll bet you've plugged in the signal generator to find out, in the real world, what is the sensitivity of your repeater's receiver. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And the answer is, yes, I have. But it's always good to bring this out so everybody else can hear it. You know, evaluate what they have to, you know, what they're hearing and say, hey, that's a good idea. Okay, let's take that one step further so I'll close this one out. Now you have a case where the receiver system in your receiving system, and some people may do this, they have a mast-mounted preamp in their system. So you can put a coupler, a tap like you just described, after the preamp, but does that really show you what the preamp is seeing or your effective receiver sensitivity is as this preamp is looking at the antenna from the real world? Back to you. How would you go about doing that, Dick?
As long as the preamp is not being saturated, this is a mast-mounted preamp, and by a bunch of testing you confirm that it is not being saturated. And one way you can confirm that is to put a spectrum analyzer in the shack on the output cable of that preamp and look at all the signals there. You know that your preamp has got 20 decibels of gain. You know that the preamp has got a frequency region where it responds from, let's assume it's a 450 preamp, and your particular preamp has got a reasonable frequency response between 200 megs and 800 megs. And those might be real numbers, by the way. So you've set the spectrum analyzer to sweep from 200 to 800, and you're looking at the output of the preamp, and if no one signal coming out of that preamp is anywhere near the 1 dB compression point. Your particular preamp may have a power output 1 dB compression point of, let's say, plus 20 dBm, and the strongest signal you see in the output of the preamp is minus 5 dBm. You know that it's very far from saturating, in which case you now know the preamp is doing its thing. It's not going into saturation. Therefore, you put your coupling device on the output of the preamp and that cable going into the receiver in the shack and measure the sensitivity. And with knowing the gain of the preamp, you can then mathematically figure out what the number of microvolts would have been if you put it into the front end of the preamp. That's one approach. The other approach would be have another piece of coaxial cable that goes up to the top of the tower with another one of those T-connecting devices right at the input of the preamp. And now you shove a signal up that cable. And because you know the insertion loss of the cable, you know how to mathematically correct everything. The insertion loss of your coupling device and the insertion loss of your auxiliary piece of cable. So there's a number of ways you can do it. And I'll bet you've done each one of those ways. Is that true, Joe? For V2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Joe.
Well, as far as W2RYY, with the preamp, I've done something a little differently, and I've actually used this for actually a system check for a like what you call loop through of the entire receiving system coming through the antenna, through your coax cable. If you have a preamp, so be it. And this method, maybe you've done this before, maybe you haven't. I've actually used an antenna, like something like a Magman antenna, close to the repeater. Well, not too close to the repeater, something for, you know, fairly far away, 25, 30 feet, when you can get that much cable. And actually put a generator out, signal out of that generator into that antenna, and actually will crank the generator up to actually measure my complete sensitivity through the air, through the antenna, through the preamp, through the cable, down to the repeater, and take the cable off the receiver, and actually measure how much gain you actually have from point to point. You have a certain amount of path loss, but you have a certain amount of gain in your system. And this way, once you know your total path loss, it's fairly constant if you don't move around and change the environment so you don't get any reflections, and if nothing else does the same thing, you can pretty much establish that I have a fixed finite path loss from the input to this cable to my receiving cable, going through the entire loop, so to speak. Then you can take a signal generator and apply a signal into that cable and basically subtract that path loss figure that you have and really get a very, very good idea of not only how the preamp works, but how low in sensitivity you can absolutely receive something, taking everything into consideration. Your antenna's performance, the preamp performance, and your noise floor that you have at a particular location. Back to you, Dick.
As you can tell, you guys that are listening, receivers are a lot of fun. And there's a zillion ways of testing them. And a two-tone test is a very good way of measuring overall systems, intercept point, third order dynamic range. There's a whole series of tests you can do with something that's called blocking dynamic range. In other words, you put a weak signal in the center of the receiver passband, and then at various spacings away, you start plugging in stronger and stronger signals at greater and greater spacing and plotting that curve of how strong the signal's got to be, how many megacycles away, in order to cause what's called blocking dynamic range. And there are some very specific frequencies you're eventually going to hit, like the image frequency and the IF frequency and the harmonics of the local oscillator and so on, where you get a very complicated curve of a really blocking dynamic range versus frequency of the offending signal. When it comes to doing a thorough electromagnetic compatibility test of the electronic hardware that's on the flight line of, let's say, a fighter or a bomber airplane, and on that airplane you've got a zillion kinds of electronics, and some of those things are transmitters, and now you try to find out which combination of electronics is in what mode of operation, and it creates what grief of those receivers. That kind of testing of all the permutations and combinations of what's on, what's off, what frequency is it tuned to, how much power is it putting out, how loudly is the person speaking into the mic of transmitter A while receiver B is trying to do the receiving. The total amount of testing can easily be a man year to find all the combinations. And was there some kind of electronic incompatibility that took place on that airliner that became lost? It's one of the very interesting questions. And those particular transmitters and receivers certainly didn't behave the way they were supposed to, if you know what I mean. And there's going to be a lot of speculation on this. Good set of questions, Joe. We'll be looking forward to more of them from you in the future. I'm going to go over to Don now. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Quebec, uniform, I think it is. You got it, Don. K2LAW in the second end. My name is Dick. One last call. Are you still with us, Don? KD2FQU? Was it FQV? You can't read my writing. Don, you know who you are. K2LAW. Go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FQU, John. I wanted to know, I actually have, a friend gave me some pure copper 70 ohm RG6, and what applications could I use that for in running an antenna?
You can run that to any antenna you want to, John. There are people who think that when you put a piece of 70 ohm cable into a 50 ohm transmitter and a 50 ohm receiver, I think all hell's going to break loose, it's going to catch on fire, and the transmitter's going to be unhappy, it's going to go to self-protect mode and whatever. In many cases, the answer is no. The real difference between 70 ohm and 50 ohm is a 1.2, is it, or 1.5 standing wave ratio. I have my calculator here. Divide 70 by 50, and you know what the number is. And I guess it's something in the vicinity of 1.2 to 1 standing wave ratio. It's rather small. If you want to be a purist, you can put an impedance matching device, a so-called quarter wave matching transformer. It really means a quarter wavelength of transmission line on one end of your 70 ohm cable, and at that piece of quarter wavelength long transmission line has got an intermediate impedance, something like 60 ohms, it will match the 50 to the 70, and so that even the impedance mismatch will go away. Let me drop. And 70 ohm cable, in general, has a lot of popularity in Europe, and it's very popular when it comes to the cable TV systems in the United States for a very good reason. If you plot all the possible impedances you can use for transmission lines, 70 of coaxial cable, 70 ohms is the impedance that has the smallest amount of loss, dB per 100 feet. 35 ohms has the most amount of power handling capability. 50 ohms, that is our standard, is sort of a compromise between those two, maximum power and minimum insertion loss. That's how we arrived at 50. That's a guess, but it maybe is a pretty good guess. So right now you're listening to my transmitter. It happens to be going through a piece of 3/4 inch 70 ohm hardline. It's a 50 ohm transmitter you're listening to, a Kenwood 711A. It's a 50 ohm transmitter going into a piece of 70 ohm hardline cable. It goes up 100 feet of tower and gets connected to a 50 ohm antenna. And I never even bothered doing any impedance matching. Now, you did say RG6. Let me drop it. Of the very small diameter cables in the quarter-inch diameter category, RG58 and RG6, RG6 is the slightly lower loss equivalent of, I can't even think of the name of the cable that everybody is using with the F connectors on all of their cable TV systems. So for that diameter, RG6 is a little higher in quality if it's the right brand name. And there are some brand names that are pretty yucky. Many of the RG6 cables are foam-filled, and the foam-filled cables do give you a lower loss. That's the good news. However, no matter how well you weatherproof the connectors on the end of any foam-filled cable, which is flexible, very slowly over the next 5 years, so to speak, a small amount of water vapor will slowly migrate through that outer polyvinyl chloride jacket, slowly migrate into the foam, and no matter what insertion loss you measure today when the cable is brand new, 5 years from now you'll be amazed how many times higher the insertion loss is because of water migration. In the case of foam-filled cable, let me drop.
I think you know 59, Dick.
Thank you. RG59 is a popular quarter-inch diameter 70-ohm cable. RG6 is a slightly higher quality version of it. And when it comes to hardline cable, where the outer conductor is a solid chunk of copper or aluminum, in that particular case, you do a good job of weatherproofing the end. No moisture can get into that foam. But when it comes to flexible cables, with foam as a dielectric, it's just a matter of time before water is going to get in there, no matter how well you weatherproof the connectors on the end. As such, I want all my cables to have low loss. Therefore, I'm using foam-filled hardline cable going up the tower. But I want a flexible piece of cable going around the rotator. common sense would lead you to believe that I'm going to use a piece of flexible foam-filled cable. I don't want water getting into that one. So even though I know that I'm getting a little bit more loss out of solid polyethylene cable, I use RG214 or RG9. It's the double-shielded version polyethylene solid dielectric cable, which can't suck up water. And that is the flexible piece that goes around my rotator. That gives me almost the lowest insertion loss for the whole system, but I've got the flexibility of rotating around the rotator, if you know what I mean, without getting water in the system. And I'm going to get, hopefully, the best possible reliability. So RG6 is a good cable, but I believe most versions of it are foam-filled, and therefore you know that the insertion loss is slowly going to creep up because you get used to it year after year. You don't even know it's happening until you went and do a test. When I chop up, let me drop. Way back in the dark ages when I put up that array of 16 Yagis, you Google my call letters, K2LIW, you'll eventually find a red QSL card which shows you 16 Yagis on 432 on top of 100 feet of tower. And that phasing harness was using FM8, which was everyone believing that this ITT cable was the Cadillac cable of the day, foam-filled, flexible, braided cable. But when Hurricane Gloria brought that antenna down and put it and deposited it into my front yard, and I took it apart and started measuring those phasing harness cables, the FM8 cables, I was amazed how much the insertion loss had increased over the 5 years that antenna had been up in the air, 4 years, 5 years, something like that. So I've now lost all faith in any flexible cable that's got foam as the dielectric if it's outdoors. Bunch of opinions, but that's where it's coming from, John. KD2, FQU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. I actually wanted to know, is there a difference between copper clad and using pure copper? And what type of connector would I have to use in order to hook it up to my rig?
Because of the so-called skin effect, John, in other words, at most of the frequencies you're likely to use, the RF energy only goes down into the outer conductor of whatever it is, the center conductor of your coax cable, or the rods of your Yagi antenna, or the 14-gauge wire of your 80-meter dipole, no matter what your RF conductor is. At most of the frequencies you and I are likely to use, the RF energy only goes down 1/10,000th of an inch, so-called skin effect. Therefore, all of your conductors can be absolutely hollow. The thin foam, a thin film of copper of the same diameter, and the RF would behave exactly the same. So what's inside of that, whether it's a copper-clad aluminum, copper-clad steel, doesn't matter. It's only the outer 10,000th of an inch where all the conducting RF energy is taking place, which is very different than your ohm meter. You put your ohm meter across that conductor, and you're measuring the full cross-section of that conductor, and you're measuring its ohms, but the RF doesn't do that. When it comes to RG6 cable, let me drop it. One possible solution for putting connectors on the end of it is to use the connectors that are made for that cable. In the bubble packs at the Radio Shack, you'll find two different kinds of F connectors. One side, one kind of F connector, a little bit smaller on the input end of it, so to speak, the back end of it, is made for RG59, and a slightly larger one is made for RG6. They also will sell you both a cheap version and an expensive version of the crimping tool that helps you put that connector on the end of the cable. So one possible approach is to put the right kind of a F connector, crimping, onto the RG6 cable, and then buy or build or whatever an adapter that goes between F and the rest of your system. And the rest of your system might be type N, UHF, BNC, doesn't matter. So F connector on the end of the cable and adapting it. Don't worry about the insertion loss of adapters. Let me drop. You tune across the 20-meter band on any day, and you're going to find people telling you that every connector and every adapter has got half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. When it comes to RF transmission line circuits, the only thing that has loss is something that has length. Your piece of coax cable might have 4.5 dB per 100 feet of loss at 432. It takes length to have loss. The adapter, if it's not made out of carbon granules, if it's a reasonable quality of the materials being used in the adapter, the hold-on adapter is only an inch long. It can't have any loss. And if you think it's got loss, put some transmitter power through it and find out if it gets hot. You'll find out real fast. Almost everything runs ice cold. So don't worry about the insertion loss of the adapter. There are guys that are afraid to put adapters and coupling bullets and whatever anywhere in their transmission line. To have that fear because of water getting into the connector, that's somewhat justified. But to have that fear because of insertion loss, not justified. Now, there are also techniques by which, let me drop. If you buy the right kind of an adapter that plugs into the back end of, let's say, a PL-259, a UHF connector, there's a kind of adapter where you stick the coax cable through it, fold back the braid, and then screw that into the back end of the UG-59. So there are ways that you can make a direct adaption between the RG6 cable and, say, for instance, a UHF connector if you want to. So there are multiple ways of doing it. No matter how you do it, you got to really worry about the portion of that connector that's outdoors. You got to do a hell of a lot of heroic things to make sure water doesn't get into it. Because at almost any frequency you and I care about, if water gets into your connector and into your cable, the insertion loss is going to climb extremely high, real fast. It's going to give you a lot of grief. Water in coaxial systems are something to really worry about. Over to you, John. KD2FQU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I actually have all the tools and cooking materials for that. Cause
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee.
Okay, Don, I think you said you've got all the tools. Kilo Charlie, Mike Hotel Yankee. Are you signing in at this time, or are you going to give us a further comment on connectors and RG6 cable? Mike Hotel Yankee, start off with your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, K2IRW, Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee. Yeah, the name is Kevin, Kilo Echo Victor, India, November. I just got another question there for the tech desk, but it doesn't have anything to do with the connectors there. Go ahead.
Very fine, Kevin. You've got Freddie and Tony in front of you, and then we're going to get to you. Freddie. I see Freddie is really there tonight with his potent signal, with his new 25-watt 7900. Kilo Bravo 2, Victor Bravo November. K2RIW, wait for the four beeps, and you've got it, Freddie.
This is KB2VBN. Yes, I want to know, just in case of power outage, how could I run this JSU mobile radio? I don't have a car or anything like that from my house in Rockaway.
Yeah, Freddie, if you were really on Long Island, that wouldn't be a problem. But you're in that place called Rockaway, along with Barry and 2MB. There are guys in your situation, Freddie, who will come up with a whole bunch of car batteries, gel cells, lead acid batteries, nickel metal hydrides, lithium ion, lipo lithium ion polymer. There's all kinds of batteries you can get your hands on. Some of them are expensive, and if you chop around and you talk to your friends, some of them are not so expensive. But to have a battery pack that has a known number of ampere hours of capability, I'm going to guess that your 25-watt transmitter probably draws something in the vicinity of 10 amperes. That's a rough guess. And as such, if you had a battery pack and you add up all the numbers that are on the side of that battery pack, let me drop. And if your car battery or your gel cells or your battery pack, your lipos, your nickel metal high, whatever batteries you're using, which may be a rechargeable, if, for instance, they all add up together to be 100 ampere hours of capacity, and the manufacturer will usually have a label on each battery telling you that. If it's 100 ampere hours, and if your particular transmitter in the 25-watt mode draws 10 amperes, then the 10 amperes divided into 100 would tell you you've got 10 hours worth of transmitting. frequency, you would be able to transmit for 10 hours before that battery pack was dead, is a rough guess. And since you're not going to be transmitting continuously, a hell of a lot of the time you're going to be doing receiving. And in the receiving mode, maybe that rig of yours only draws half an ampere, then quite possibly it'll be able to receive for two solid days, if you know what I mean, if you're in the receive mode. So batteries with a charger, that's one possible approach. Another possible approach is that if you talk to Dave, what can I think of Dave's call letters right now? N2APJ. Dave is sort of the expert on very inexpensive small motor generator sets. Let me get out. Dave could probably suggest for you a generator that puts out 500 watts, maybe even 300 watts. He can find some small little generator that you could hold in the palm of your hand that runs on gasoline, and the thing is probably going to use 1 gallon for 24 hours, and while it's running, it's giving you a couple of hundred watts of power, and therefore it'll run your rig. So when it comes to energy density, that generator I just mentioned, running on gasoline, has a hell of a lot more watt-hours per pound or watt-hours per cubic foot than batteries. The good news about batteries is they're nice and simple. The bad news is that you take 50 pounds of batteries and you figure out how long you're going to be operating the transmitter versus 50 pounds worth of gasoline. The 50 pounds worth of gasoline into a generator is going to run your radios for 10 times longer than the batteries, if you know. So it's a trade-off. You want the simplicity of batteries, or do you want to use a motor generator set? And for the rest of us who own an automobile, that cigarette lighter in the automobile, let me drop it. That cigarette lighter on the automobile puts you in contact with a beautiful, completely portable power supply that you can always recharge it by turning on the automobile and letting the motor run in the idle mode, and the alternator will charge your battery. So those are some of the approaches, Freddie. There probably are other techniques, and that is Far Rockaway, on a good day, does get a whole lot of sunlight. So if you had a whole bunch of solar cells charging your batteries while you're using the transmitter, then during the daytime you would never even be discharged at all. Also, a much more difficult approach, but it's something just to at least consider, Far Rockaway does have a lot of wind. So if you had a wind generator, you'd have renewable energy. So a wind generator, solar voltaics, motor generator set, and batteries. Some combination of that is going to give you all the power you need, Freddie. KB2, VBN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Let us know what you decide.
Hey, Roger, I was thinking about that little tiny generator. I could put that right outside my window and put a little gas in there and start it up there.
Net.
Yeah, that would work like a charm. You get a hold of Dave, N2APG. He's the guy who is sort of the expert on that subject of small motor generators, nice and quiet, portable, and they sip gasoline at the rate of about 1 gallon for 24 hours. He's the expert on that one. He can suggest for you which surplus dealer you go to. You don't spend very many dollars, you get a real nice generator. Let us know what you decide on that one, Tony. Freddie, is there somebody else in the process of signing in? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
G2WGB with a comment on the RG60.
Go right ahead, John.
I think I'd like John to know that he doesn't have to go through much trouble with the RG6, especially if it's the quad shield. He can use the L259 connector with reducing ferrule for RG58, and he may have to broach it slightly or maybe even drill it out, and the RG6 will fit right in there. And with quad shield, he has plenty of copper braid to solder to, and that I've done before, works very well. And you're right, that cable will work fine. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, you just said something very interesting, John. I didn't know that some of the brands of RG6 have quad shield, whatever that means. And do many of the RG6s, are they foam-filled? And so if it's a flexible braided cable that's foam-filled, if it's got a real good outer foil,